Tsar officers to pass millions of rubles in small concealments to the agents. A few months later, a top-level Soviet scientist, acting on instructions from his OWVL message, approached a high-voltage transmission tower outside of Moscow. There, as instructed, he picked up a brick at a specific location that matched the dead drop description he was given. Something must be wrong, the agent concluded, because this was identical to all the other bricks scattered around the area by workers who erected the tower. Discarding the brick, he headed to the bus for the journey home, wondering what had gone wrong. Several anxious days passed as the case officer awaited confirmation that the agent had successfully unloaded the dead drop. Then came word that the agent had indeed gone to the site, but no special brick had been seen. An OWVL broadcast quickly followed, reiterating the instructions, with assurances that the ordinary-appearing brick he had discarded was indeed a very special one. It was a modest but important success. The guys in TSD were technically adept, but they were coming over into the operational lion's den, remembered George. We who did Moscow operations were the most security-conscious part of the whole SR division, which was the most buttoned-up part of the CIA. I mean, it was tight, and TSD never had the benefit of having a tech assigned in Moscow or dealing closely with denied area case officers in operational planning. At first, they didn't realize all the points we were always thinking about, worrying about. A new way of thinking about the operational environment and technology in denied areas was required of both case officer and engineer. For case officers, this meant understanding that technology used in satellites could be adapted and applied for operations on the streets of Moscow or Leningrad. For TSD's engineers, this meant experiencing the realities of operating in the denied area and integrating that knowledge into the design of clandestine gear. Success demanded that much of the traditional compartmentation of laboratory development from the field operations end. Section 3. In the Passing Lane. Chapter 7. Moving Through the Gap. Adversity is a good teacher. Russian proverb. The U-2 spy planes and Corona satellites that produced spectacular new intelligence from their successful first missions overshadowed the slow evolution of technology used by human spies in the early 1960s. TSD Chief Sid Gottlieb, who replaced Russell in 1966, remained unwavering in his belief that technology would become an integral role in agent operations. During Russell's 4 years in the division, the two officers had become lifelong friends and shared the view that the KGB's massive security apparatus was vulnerable to U.S. technology. In the pre-digital, analog environment of the mid-1960s, this confidence in technology was not routinely accepted in the DDP. Gottlieb continued to rely on George Sachs to bridge the gap between the operations and technology. As case officers began to use the increasing store of TSD equipment available, new problems arose. One recurring dilemma was communications between case officers and engineers. The cultural divide between the pragmatic engineers of TSD and the liberal arts types in the DDP was one not only of background, but of language. Technology brought with it a vocabulary that was not always clear to the outsider. The potential for confusion was compounded by the already colorful espionage vernacular. This was illustrated when a case officer asked TSD to fabricate a phone tap. What he wanted was a device that logged the numbers dialed for outgoing calls to identify the contacts of a target. Hearing the words phone tap, TSD built a system that covertly taped the target's conversations but did not collect the numbers dialed. Gottlieb understood the necessity for operational compartmentation, but technical requirements had to be precisely translated if TSD was to build the right gear. Misuse of words, misunderstanding of technical concepts, lack of clearly defined operational requirements, and excessive application of compartmentation all contributed to operational failures. George's job was to make sure that SR's operational needs were well-defined and clearly communicated to the engineers of TSD. One significant step that Gottlieb took to bridge this gap was to invite George, as a representative of the SR division, to TSD's annual retreat. Convened at a covert testing and training facility on an island off the East Coast, the event was a chance for senior scientists, engineers, and craftsmen to let their hair down. A seemingly small thing in retrospect, George's presence caused a stir at the time. They'd sit in an auditorium in a group and say things like, "What I don't like is that this group over there is not providing me the kind of support I need to do my job." Or, "We have a new idea with a contractor, and we need $50,000, but can't get the money," recalled George. So when I showed up, guys were pointing at me and saying, "Who let him in? An operations guy listening to us talk about our problems?" Gottlieb told them, "We need to have more trust with operational elements that we support. If he goes back and tells his people we have some problems, what else is new?" That was an effort by a very smart director of TSD to break down the wall and get a better flow of information. I can't overemphasize how revolutionary that was to people in TSD. The assignment of two senior DDP officers, Everett C. O'Neill and Quentin Johnson, as Gottlieb's deputies, also served to build bridges between the technical and operational. Johnson had first-hand knowledge of the dangers surrounding denied area operations, having served as one of the principal CIA case officers handling Penkovsky a decade earlier. As head of TSD, Gottlieb began shaking things up inside the division. He instituted a program of daily operational briefings in a conference area that became known as the Situation Room. "Every afternoon, beginning at about 4, the bosses had to go into the Situation Room," recalled a chemist. On one wall hung a huge map of the world with pins representing a tech, somewhere, doing something operational. Those responsible for secret writing would not normally hear about audio because the individual operations and targets were compartmented. But with this briefing, TSD chiefs were forced to think about the problems and requirements faced in other disciplines. Gottlieb had little tolerance for personality differences or rivalries within the division. When long simmering tensions between two TSD chiefs showed no signs of dissipating, he put them in the same office. "They shared a small office. Their desks faced each other, head to head," recalled a TSD staff member. Sid was quoted as saying, "They may refuse to talk to each other, but by God, they're going to sit there and look at each other all day." Gottlieb's personal attention to the TSD family became legendary. He called staff and officers on their birthdays and remembered spouses and hobbies. "It sounds hokey, but he had a touch with that kind of thing," said a TSD chemist. It came across as, "The boss knows me." As TSD and Soviet Russia Division were beginning to mesh internally, a bureaucratic and political turf war raged among the CIA's senior officers. From its inception, TSD had been a part of the agency's operational directorate, but with the formation of the Directorate of Research in 1962, the organizational position of TSD became a matter of debate. DCI John McCone believed that all agency technical capabilities should be centralized. Conversely, Richard Helms, deputy director for plans at the time, opposed moving TSD to the new directorate and argued successfully that operations needed a technical component at their right arm. Helms then became DCI, and for the next decade, TSD remained in the operational directorate. President Nixon moved to replace Helms by nominating James Schlesinger in December 1972 as the successor. Schlesinger became DCI in February 1973 and almost immediately initiated a major reorganization of the agency. TSD was realigned from the DO to the DS&T. The move also brought TSD a new name, Office of Technical Service, OTS, and a new chief from the DS&T, John McMahon. Gottlieb retired in May 1973. The internal turbulence was soon matched by controversy on Capitol Hill. when OSS veteran William Colby followed Schlesinger as DCI, political clamor about the CIA's activities in the 1950s and 1960s erupted. In December of 1974, the New York Times investigative journalist Seymour Hersh revealed evocative CIA crypts, cryptonyms like MH Chaos and MK Ultra, and described past operations within the United States. One of the most damaging revelations was the agency's involvement, along with the FBI, in opening the mail of U.S. citizens. As a result, both Congress and the Ford administration conducted investigations. The Church Committee in the Senate, the Pike Commission in the House of Representatives, and the presidential-appointed Rockefeller Commission each examined past CIA activities deemed illegal, improper, or misguided. Intent on making a full disclosure, Colby released sensitive and previously closely held operational details referred to as the agency's family jewels. Ordered by Schlesinger, the family jewels documents had been hastily compiled in 1973 during the Watergate inquiries. Colby made the highly classified material available to a Senate committee headed by Frank Church. He then unintentionally provided an impromptu visual coup for the Church Committee on September 16, 1975, by displaying an ominous-looking pistol called a non-discernible micro-bio-inoculator. The press dubbed the weapon the CIA dart gun. In fact, it was not a CIA device, but the result of a Fort Detrick research and development program. The weapon, along with others developed by the Army, had been sent to Langley and other elements of the intelligence community for evaluation and comment. Colby had taken the pistol to the committee meeting, thinking it would be of interest as a curiosity, a miscalculation that inadvertently and permanently linked the agency to the weapon. Information about CIA activities from reports of the Church Committee and the Rockefeller Commission provided a more complete picture of post-World War II U.S. intelligence than had ever been seen. Several OTS officers were investigated or subpoenaed as a result of their participation in drug testing projects, assassination planning, mail opening, or support to Nixon's White House plumbers in the Watergate break-in. Eventually, all of OTS's activities were found to have been part of approved operations, and not a single OTS officer was found guilty of any wrongdoing. While Washington was preoccupied with the politics of scandal, technology was advancing at lightning speed. Personal computers, called micros in the parlance of the day, were entering the mainstream. Once the domain of hobbyists and large organizations, these new systems, with their unwieldy 5- and 8-inch floppy disks, pointed toward an unexplored world of digitally stored information. The future could also be glimpsed in the hands of teenagers playing a video game called Pong from a new company with the strange name Atari. In U.S. research labs, scientists were laying the digital groundwork for the wired world. ARPANET, a Department of Defense distributed computer network, was quietly expanding into a communication system that would evolve into the Internet within 2 decades. For OTS, the question was, how quickly could viable and reliable spy gear be built integrating this new technology? Like their OSS R&D counterparts, OTS engineers recognized that technology flowing from private industry could meet intelligence requirements. Technology for espionage seemed poised to match the imaginations of screenwriters who dreamed up fictions such as The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Mission Impossible. A pen communicator or a self-destructing taped message seemed plausible. The transistor, which had revolutionized audio surveillance operations a decade earlier when it supplanted the vacuum tube, was now being replaced by the microchip. The reliable, affordable Xerox copier ended the labor-intensive need for OTS techs to photograph, develop, and print copies of sensitive documents agents secretly lent to case officers. For OTS, the question became which one of the technologies to pursue. Early in 1975, an OTS scientist was invited to the lab of an engineer in another part of the agency. "I have a technology you guys really ought to look at," explained the engineer. At the lab, the OTS scientist saw an experimental setup that allowed for storage and retrieval of relatively large amounts of digital information in a very small sphere. Aptly named bubble memory, the storage technology could be used to create a new short-range agent communications, SHRAC, device. At the time, SHRAC systems could store and transmit only a limited number of characters. With bubble memory, it might be possible to store and transmit entire pages of data. The scientist proposed the project as a practical solution to the communication problem. A few days later, he received an estimate of $50,000 to build a bench model of a bubble memory module for a SHRAC device. Even more quickly, the answer came back, "That's too much money," and the project wilted. 18 months later, funds appeared, but too late for bubble memory, which was already overtaken by the inexpensive and adaptable read-only memory, ROM. Literally, technology was advancing faster than the government's funding process. Another compelling technology quietly emerging was the charge-coupled device, CCD, developed by researchers at Bell Labs in the late 1960s. Originally conceived as a memory storage device, each CCD chip is made up of an array of light-sensitive capacitors. As photons hit the CCD, an electron is dislodged, creating a small electrical charge to form a pattern that varies in degree to the intensity of the light. By focusing light through a lens, the pattern becomes well-defined, similar to the chemical reaction of photographic film. A software program that remembers where individual charges are located creates the picture. Instead of the image's resolution being determined by the size of the silver grains on the film, the number of capacitors, or pixels, defines detail. In 1974, OTS began building its first digital imager. Rather than copying documents with film cameras, the idea was to replace film with a linear array of imaging sensors from the emerging CCD technology. With a modest investment through a classified contract, OTS engineers worked with a team of scientists at a leading American electronics company to develop a camera that would work as well in an agent's hands as the KH-11 imagers, cameras, worked from space. It would take more than 10 years for a product to emerge, a remarkable black box called a filmless camera that captured and stored digital images. More important for clandestine operations, the black box contained a feature for digital transmission of the electronic images, turning the camera into a two-way COVCOM device. By 1989, OTS had a piece of spy gear that worked like a cell phone's digital camera. Advances in technology both radically reduced size and increased capabilities of spy gear. Size reduction expanded possibilities for concealment, minimized power requirements, and improved an agent's ability to conceal it, carry it, dead-drop it, and use it. "Can't we make it smaller?" and "Why is this so big?" may have been the most frequently asked questions of OTS engineers. Chapter 8. The Pen is Mightier Than the Sword and Shield. Question. What is a Soviet trio? Answer. A quartet returning from an overseas tour. 1970s underground Soviet humor. In 1973, a Soviet diplomat stationed in Colombia entered the steam room of the Bogota Hilton. A few minutes later, another man casually joined him and struck up a conversation in Spanish. The Soviet was Alexander Ogorodnik, a member of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the other a CIA case officer. What appeared to be a chance meeting in an unlikely location was actually part of a finely coordinated plan to recruit Ogorodnik to spy inside the Soviet Union. An economist with a specialty in Latin America, Ogorodnik had access to information about Soviet policy through his diplomatic status and assignment. Here was a chance for the United States to learn what the Soviet leadership was thinking and planning for its Latin American policy. If successful, This operation could provide sustained, detailed intelligence on Soviet plans and intentions not available from satellites. Soviet officials were more accessible in countries outside the Soviet Union, but recruiting them was still no easy task. As much as possible, the Soviets tried to create a security cordon around their diplomats. Soviets living abroad were watched carefully by their own security officers stationed in the embassy, who, ever alert for a hint of the smallest political crime, would make note of something as harmless as attending a foreign movie. Soviet missions were laced with stukachi, informers, eager to curry favor with superiors by reporting any trivial transgression. Soviet diplomats were required to report even a casual conversation with Americans to the security officer at the KGB Residentura station inside the embassy. Most complied with the restrictions because, compared to conditions in Moscow, foreign living was luxurious. These diplomats had prospered under the Soviet regime and guarded their elite status jealously. However, when the case officer entered the steam room that day, he had every reason to believe the Soviet economist could be recruited. According to CIA assessments, Ogorodnik was different. Unconventional by the standards of the Soviet diplomatic community, he was known to like the good life and enjoyed a Western lifestyle that included a nice car and a poodle. Ogorodnik also had three problems that made him vulnerable to recruitment. The first was that a KGB officer in the embassy was trying to recruit him to work as an informer. Such a role would place additional demands on the diplomat's life, while turning down the invitation could generate questions of loyalty. Ogorodnik's second dilemma was that, although married, he had a Colombian mistress, and she was pregnant with his child. This led to the third problem. He would be compelled to return to Moscow when his tour ended. Trapped in a diplomatic soap opera that involved a failing marriage, pregnant mistress, career ambitions, and the KGB, Ogorodnik faced a difficult situation. Once contact was established, it became evident to the case officer that Ogorodnik had both strong motivations and character traits to become a spy. He hated the Soviet system and was prepared to work against it, though was not foolish. He required compensation and precautions. In exchange for his commitment, funds would be deposited into an escrow account to support his mistress and child in the short term. In the long term, after an undetermined period, the agency would assist him in defecting. The CIA gave Ogorodnik a code name, Trigon, and insisted that as few people as possible be involved in the operation, since the more people who knew about his secret work, the greater the risk that one of them would betray him. However, to be securely handled inside the Soviet Union, Trigon needed intensive tradecraft training before returning to Moscow. George Sachs got the call. The instructions were precise. He was to close up everything else he was working on and concentrate all his efforts on Trigon. He could talk to no one about the new assignment, in which he was to train the agent and create a communications plan for passing photographs of documents to the CIA in Moscow. Although the training would take place in Colombia, there were still security concerns. The KGB had a strong presence in the country and maintained close ties with local sources, including police, journalists, and government employees. Ogorodnik's Western lifestyle made him a high-profile personality within the diplomatic community, and local KGB officers were monitoring him as part of their own recruitment campaign. It took George a month to work out a training and commo plan. Since he spoke and wrote excellent Russian, he would conduct the training himself in Colombia with an OTS tech available for technical consultation and assistance. Unlike Penkovsky, Trigon was not a professional intelligence officer. He would require basic instruction in tradecraft and operational techniques, including the use of dead drops, signal sights, brush passes, car tosses, and accommodation addresses. This would be followed by a series of more advanced covert technology and tradecraft techniques, such as document photography, receiving OWVL broadcasts, using one-time pads for encryption and decryption, secret writing, and microdot reading. Even for professionals, comprehensive operational training takes months of study and years to perfect. Now, in a room in the Bogota Hilton, George had the daunting task of schooling a spy to operate in the toughest counterintelligence environment in the world in a matter of weeks. Among the devices issued to Trigon was a new OTS ultra-miniature camera. Work on the sub-miniature camera that began in early 1970 had a direct connection to Penkovsky. Quentin Johnson, during his assignment to TSD, pressed for development of a camera that an asset could use to photograph documents while inside a KGB residentura. Initially, the technical requirements seemed nearly impossible. In addition to being able to capture high-resolution images of a full page without distortion at the edges or benefit of flash, the camera needed a film capacity of at least 100 frames and a silent shutter system. Added to this, the camera had to be small enough to conceal in an item that a person would normally carry with them into guarded and secure facilities. OTS responded with a sub-miniature camera design that carried the designation T-100. Just 1/6 the size of the Minox issued to Penkovsky a decade earlier, its small size and cylindrical shape allowed the T-100 to be integrated into a wide variety of personal items, such as pens, watches, cigarette lighters, or key fobs. A jewel of watchmaking mechanical precision and optical miniaturization, the camera's 4mm diameter lens was made up of 8 elements. Tiny, precisely ground glass elements, some only a bit larger than a pinhead, were exactingly stacked, one on top of another, to achieve clarity in photographing a standard 8.5 by 11 inch page. The craftsmanship and the technology that went into making the lens assembly was something that may never be repeated, said George, more than 3 decades after the camera was first introduced. The T-100's film, lens, and shutter mechanism were housed in a single aluminum casing that measured 1.5 inches long and 3/8 of an inch in diameter. As each picture was snapped, the film automatically advanced from one tiny spool inside the cassette to another, making it the world's smallest point-and-shoot camera. Under optimum conditions, the camera's 15-inch film strip could hold approximately 100 exposures. Built under tight security to OTS specs by a precision optical contractor, the T-100 was designed specifically for document copying. An agent could appear to be studying a technical manual, engineering drawings, or a policy paper, and noiselessly snap photos by holding the camera in his closed fist 11 inches above the target. Since the lens design allowed some tolerance in the focus distance, most users could place their two elbows at normal shoulder width on a table and, with the document between them, conceal the camera in clasped hands at the apex of the triangle. In other document copy operations, agents could mount a 35mm camera on a tripod, frame the document, snap away, and be assured of quality pictures. With the T-100, the agent became the tripod and needed to position the camera precisely for each image. Although the film advanced automatically with each exposure, there was no autofocus function, and without a viewfinder, it was difficult to be certain the document was centered. Nothing about the T-100 was ordinary, right down to the film it required. Due to the size of the cassette spools and operational realities that favored packing as many images as possible in a single cassette, extremely thin film with high resolution was needed. OTS engineers found the solution not in custom-made film, but in retired stocks of Kodak 1414 film used in early satellite photography programs. Because of the sensitivity to payload weight in satellite launches, the film was designed with ultra-thin emulsion and backing. OTS sliced the film into 5mm wide 15-inch strips to fit on the T-100 spools. Big technology had once again assisted with the smallest of devices. Loading the film into the sub-miniature cassettes required a skill that few could master. The small lengths of film were loaded by hand and wound around the tiny spool, either in total darkness or with the aid of an infrared viewer. Then, once the film was loaded,